This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Emily Score, CEO of Growth Energy. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Growth Energy's Emily Score next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The renewable fuels industry has clawed its way into a significant percentage of the U.S. liquid fuels industry, but has the potential to grow even further. Regulatory decisions and litigation ultimately may determine what opportunities lie ahead for farmers and refiners, and whether the Biden administration's climate goals ultimately will be met. Growth Energy's Emily Score says renewable fuel should be a part of the debate in the race for the White House.
There's, of course, a difference between campaigning and governing. And what we always try to do, and where we have had good success, is make sure that there are affirmative statements of concrete support for our policy priorities on a campaign trail, so we can hold the president and the administration's feet to the fire, if you will. And we've been able to do that with some success, not 100% success, but some success. So that is part of the exercise. That is part of what we have to do when it comes to advocacy and working with the policymakers in Washington, D.C. Importantly, I think we absolutely have a role to play in this upcoming election. I don't think there is a path to the White House, either on the Republican side or the Democratic side, that does not include getting the support of the Midwest. And so certainly, historically, our greatest opportunity is usually on the Iowa caucus, where we really bring the most attention to biofuels and ethanol. But there are some swing states that are in play that are going to receive a lot of attention. And so we would like to see more from both sides, from both candidates, as they're talking about what it is that they will do to make sure they're supporting the rural economy, that they're supporting ethanol, and they're supporting our ability to grow and expand the rural economy.
How big of a setback of the court overturning the previous SRE exemptions?
That's frustrating. And as an industry, we were all very excited to see how this current administration had taken a different approach to SREs and had really shut the door on the abusive handout of small refinery exemptions to the renewable fuel standard. But that story isn't over. And when this EPA started issuing a host of denials, this EPA has not granted, I don't believe, any small refinery exemptions. Then you had the refiners go to the courts. You're talking about recently the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals vacated a series of EPA SRE denials, which essentially means the court simply says, EPA, you have to reevaluate your decision. So it's disappointing, but it's not the end of the story, because then the question is, well, what will EPA do? This is most likely going to be action taken under the next administration. So what will the next administration's EPA do? We believe that the original decisions to deny the exemptions were based on sound economic analysis. That's what we have long argued in all of our legal support of those decisions. We've said before, the economic hardship that refiners claim to experience is really accounting fiction. So this is going to be a big part of the portfolio for the next administration. And that's going to therefore be a big part of our advocacy as an industry, to make sure that we limit the amount of SREs that are granted, because it is some accounting fiction. And if there are any granted, you reallocate that requirement and redistribute it throughout the rest of the refinery.
How big is that sector? How big is that volume to the bottom line of the renewable fuels industry?
You know, Jeff, it's hard to say. We're still trying to unpack this, because some of this decision is still under seal. So we're still trying to figure out, we're kind of guessing at some of the numbers. But I can say, just based on the Fifth Circuit decision earlier this year and the D.C. Circuit decision, we have well over 100 SRE denials that are now back in play. That's several billion gallons of RINs. So it's a substantial number. It's something that we are paying close attention to and that we will have to really focus our attention on moving forward.
If there has been a pattern from the Environmental Protection Agency, it has been being late for making announcements with regard of RVOs under the RFS. And as I recall, Growth Energy is threatening litigation over the delayed 2026 RFS rule. Why is it important that this information come in a timely basis?
We are threatening litigation, you're right, and we've certainly done it before. It is very critical for the businesses to have certainty and clarity. By statute, EPA should have the 2026 renewable volume obligations. They should be done and out, known to the world by November of this year. They're going to miss that deadline. And our position is that the law doesn't change just because EPA gives advance notice, we're going to miss the deadline. And so we need to know what these things are so the businesses can make decisions. They're chronically behind. We have chronically taken action, and that's led to some, you know, consent decrees where we've been able to get them to finally commit to timelines for the RFS set. But it looks like we're going to have to kind of make sure that we hold them accountable moving forward. So we filed an intent to sue. It doesn't mean that we will, but we're saying this is an option that we are keeping on the table for ourselves, and we'll make the decision in the months ahead.
So how does this affect the industry if those announcements are late?
Well, unfortunately, we as an industry have been dealing with this chronically for several years, but it affects our ability to have certainty in terms of the business decisions. And I think where we see the most effect is on the growth of E15. If you have an RFS where we know what the obligations are going to be, we know the blending requirements are going to stand, there's not going to be an exemption granted, that's where you're going to help really see a huge growth in E15 gallons, because we will have to get those gallons blended to comply with the RFS. And that's always been our frustration over the years, is if RFS were administered the way it's intended to be administered, with no little kind of backdoor caveats or small refinery exemptions, we would be well beyond that 15 billion gallons of conventional blending.
So the Supreme Court made a decision with regard to Chevron. Does that come into play now as the EPA is making its own determinations with regard to previously approved law by the Congress?
Well, so this is going to be interesting. And the impact of the Supreme Court's reversal of their Chevron deference doctrine, which goes back to a 1984 court decision, it's going to take some time, because we have to see how the lower courts interpret that. And so we're going to have to see, how do the lower courts interpret the Supreme Court decisions across cases involving the RFS, the IRA, or other parts of the Clean Air Act? I mean, there's no doubt that this decision gives courts much more authority to review and second guess federal agency rulemaking and other regulatory activities. That was the intent of the decision. And so, you know, what does this mean for us as an industry? It's going to take some time, but I can say a few things. Importantly, in our litigation and our rulemaking comments around the RFS historically, we have not relied on the Chevron deference doctrine. We focused on the best meaning of statutory provisions. So we're in a good place to continue with what has been our leading arguments about why the RFS should be administered the way it should be. So that isn't going to really affect so much kind of our legal arguments. On the rulemaking side, when we're doing our advocacy with the agencies, we'll continue to focus on what the statute language actually says. And of course, as we look forward as an industry to future legislation, we will have to pay more attention to the language in the law, because we'll want it to be as detailed and prescriptive as possible, so you don't have ambiguity, you don't have a lack of clarity, you don't have silence. Because silence, that's the silence or the ambiguity, that's where that could potentially affect us down the road. So we'll have to be really attentive as we're looking at new laws that are going to be passed, and make sure that we plan ahead and we game out what the courts might do if they're interpreting agency action.
Some might wonder if it's out of the skillet and into the fire, deferring to an agency, or then seeing the court system make a decision, because not all rulings toward renewable fuel or agriculture in these areas have been clear cut from the courts.
This is true. And so that's why it isn't clear cut for us, because there are times as an industry when we benefit from agencies having some discretion in what they do. And there are times when we agree with what they've done, and there are times that we disagree. And so, it depends on where you sit on what particular issue. But again, you know, in terms of our legal defense of the RFS, we have really good legal arguments that haven't been reliant on that doctrine. And moving forward, we have to be really attentive to making sure that we have a written record that we can point to that says this is what the agency should be doing. And this is what the agency has the authority to do.
Emily, looking at the calendar, there is a new set of rules coming from the Treasury called 45Z. Now, we saw the precursor to that in the 40B, and agriculture and renewable fuels had some areas to celebrate, but also areas of concern. How important is it that these rules encompass and make it available for crop feedstocks across the country and the U.S. to be able to participate?
Well, it's critically important. The details matter. And we either have a great opportunity for us as an industry where we can capitalize on this tax credit, and we will see an infusion of innovation and investment that will take us, I think, to the next step as an industry, or we won't. And so, of course, you're talking about 45Z as the Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit. It takes effect January 1 of next year. We have been waiting for guidance from Treasury. Okay, how are you going to administer? How will you determine who's eligible for the tax credit? And what's really, really important for us is that the guidance coming out from Treasury, we'd like it to be a rulemaking. It might be a rulemaking. It might be guidance. But that it gives us maximum flexibility to the farmers in terms of what they do with their farming practices, that they have the ability to elect different things based on their soil, based on their geography, based on what's available to them, and maximum flexibility for the ethanol producers and what we're doing at the plant. So just kind of some numbers for comparison. If you look at, we need the maximum amount of feedstocks that have a baseline default carbon intensity score assigned to them. And that's what we need. So right now, and we've provided comments to USDA. They asked for requested some information. We provide the detailed comments. You know, there are at least 8 feedstocks that we want to qualify for non-SAF fuels and 11 as an SAF feedstock. That's a lot. There are about 20 technologies that my members are currently employing or looking at employing, things that they can do at the plant that reduce the carbon intensity, but they have to get credit for that. And so our comments were very specific to give farmers flexibility. Don't require them to have to do 2 or 3 or any number of farming practices. Don't bundle and say you have to do all of these at once. Give the farmer flexibility. Do what you can that makes sense for you, and we'll make sure that we have a strong carbon intensity score assigned to it, and the same thing at the plant.
If these are stringent rules, not as many feedstocks apply, and it doesn't seem as though then the administration's goal of cleaner environment would be accomplished.
Well, that's, of course, our overall message as an industry to the administration. We can help you achieve your goals. If you want to decarbonize transportation, if you want to help decarbonize agriculture, we can help you get there. We biofuels can help incentivize some changes that would be taking place on the farm, because we can provide value through passing on some of that tax credit. But we've got to give us the ability to deploy every technology available for the farmer to do anything that he or she chooses to do. Don't tie our hands. And here's, you know, just for numbers, and this I think is a number from kind of the corn growers. The 40B guidance, so the precursor to 45Z, required that farmers have to do cover crop and no-till and a fertilizer requirement. When it comes to cover crops and no-till, only about 15% of the U.S. corn acres could conceivably do both no-till and cover crop. Well, that is not at all the intent of what this administration is trying to do. You want 100% of corn acres to be eligible. So that just gives you a perspective in terms of how much work we have to do to really expand the rules and the framework so that most people are eligible, and we're incentivizing the most change as quickly as we can.
Emily, what are the consequences if the 45Z rule is too restrictive? And what are the rewards, if you will, if these rules are inclusive for feedstocks from farmers in the U.S.?
Well, all right, so we'll start with, if 45Z is too restrictive, it simply won't be used. It's not something that we as an industry will have the ability to tap into. The reverse of that is if 45Z is maximized in terms of its potential. So we actually did some research on, we commissioned some research on this. You're looking at $21 billion added to the U.S. economy, $13.4 billion in household income, an additional more than 190,000 jobs across all sectors, and of course some additional premium on low-carbon corn used at an ethanol plant. So there's real dollars and cents on the table in terms of economic opportunity. And we are working very hard to educate lawmakers and policymakers on the economics and what's at stake, and you know, the what won't happen if we don't get the policy right.
How gratifying was it to have some of the top scientists back industry claims that Growth Energy and others have been suggesting for years?
Well, it's incredibly exciting. Recently, there were 8 independent scientists. So these are among the most prominent agricultural, biomass, and greenhouse gas life cycle experts. They came together. They filed an amicus brief as part of the RFS set litigation. So this is something that they did on their own. They said, my gosh, we've been watching this conversation. The courts need to hear from us. And so they very much validated what we have long been saying, what the data are saying in terms of our de minimis impact on the environment, the fact that biofuel ethanol production is not likely to affect endangered species. And so it was important, it was helpful, it was gratifying. We certainly hope that the courts take notice. And it's something that we will point to in our future advocacy, because this is something that these are independent voices doing something, you know, on their own that they believe the courts need to pay attention to. So it's exciting to see that.
Technology continues to advance, but what does sustainable aviation fuel mean to the renewable fuels industry, whether you're able to participate or if you're left out?
Well, you know, SAF is this exciting new frontier for us. But it's still a nascent industry. And so we are not making ethanol today. It's not being used as a feedstock for SAF. What's exciting about it is this is a hard to electrify sector. And so ethanol is the only feedstock that's really available in the volume that you need to meet some of these grand goals and the grand challenges set forth by the administration, which wants 3 billion gallons of sustainable aviation fuel produced and used in the U.S. by 2030. So it's an exciting kind of blue sky market opportunity for us. I've had several member companies that have already, early on when the administration first announced this grand challenge, jumped in and said, we will commit that we'll be able to help you achieve this goal. But we need a couple things first in order for us to get there. And it does come back to this 45Z tax incentive. We've got to be able to decarbonize and get credit for the decarbonization. And that's where that 45Z tax credit comes into play. One thing that is important for us as an industry is carbon capture and sequestration. That is a technology that allows a plant to cut their carbon intensity pretty much in half. And so that's something that's under active discussion for a lot of plants that either have the ability to potentially sequester on a geologic formation that's on or, you know, near the plant, or tap into a proposed pipeline. So we need the ability to have that technology deployed and implemented. We need tax guidance that's going to help us employ these technologies. And honestly, Jeff, you know, we need 45Z to be extended. And that's a big part of the conversation. It's a 3-year tax credit. That's not enough time. The amount of capital investment required for plants to reduce their carbon intensity, to build that SAF facility, we need more than 3 years. We need something more like 10 years. So that's an active part of our conversation here in Washington, is we're going to have to get an extension to that, because that's when the businesses are really going to see, all right, I've got that market. I'm going to be going for it full throttle.
How crucial are pipelines to the success of the renewable fuels industry's participation in sustainable aviation fuel or in liquid transportation fuels?
it's a really important component of our ability to successfully be a, you know, a feedstock for SAF and decarbonize. And so that's why there's so much attention paid to it. As an industry, it's an important conversation to make sure that communities are supportive and understand this is a technology. It's safe. We're already using it. It's going to help the rural economy. And so I have confidence that those local conversations continue, I think, to take place and make progress. But it's an important technology that we want to be able to embrace. And when we can do that, then we're really, you know, if you sequester the ethanol, that brings you down into the place where then you can really do some exciting things in terms of what you're doing with growers and some of the other technologies at the plants. And we're looking at being, you know, lower than net zero as an industry. We've got a lot of potential to decarbonize. We just need some clear signals from Washington, D.C. that allow us and some support for some of these exciting technologies.
I recall the day of Keith Collins, chief economist at the Department of Agriculture, and some of the discussion was about miscanthus and switchgrass and cellulosic ethanol. Where's cellulosic ethanol now? And are you lending support still in that area? Is the industry still looking in that direction?
I think the industry is looking really in all directions. Still, I think there's a lot on the cellulosic front. I think the more recent conversation has been on kind of corn kernel fiber, and some opportunities there and making sure that those pathways are approved at the EPA. You know, corn kernel fiber can produce cellulosic ethanol. And there are pathways that California has approved that EPA has yet to approve. So that's been a big part of the conversation. But what's exciting is, if, as you're looking ahead to decarbonize, I mean, that allows a plant to get some additional, extra resources, you know, revenue. And so I think that's still kind of a conversation, and different plants are kind of taking it in different directions.
Emily, do you feel that the Biden administration is picking winners and losers in the transportation fuel industry and the automotive industry?
Now, the Biden administration has been very clear and very consistent. They are looking to electrify the light-duty fleet. And that is reflected in a lot of policies, and in particular their fuel economy standards, the tailpipe emission standards, that really the current standards, beginning for the model year 2027, they're a de facto EV mandate. And so we've been very vociferous in our pushback, and we have for years, as well now with these standards, that the administration, if the goal is to decarbonize, then you have to look at the potential to decarbonize within liquid fuels. And that's where we come into play. Look at what you can do if you optimize an engine and a low carbon fuel that uses a higher blend of ethanol. You can really take carbon reductions. You can really cut them down. But the administration ignored that completely and did choose one technology and said, no, we're going to do it through electrification. It's short-sighted. They're not going to be able to achieve their stated goals in the time frame that they're looking at. So, yes, that's a big part of our conversation as an industry as a whole and as a liquid fuels industry as a whole.
Well, Emily Skor, thank you very much in the midst of a very busy travel season for you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Emily, you've been here before. You know that in Open Mic, you have the last word.
The biggest question that I get asked, of course, by our industry right now is people are looking at the 2024 elections and what happens with the new administration. And I am so excited and optimistic about the opportunities for our industry ahead. One of our greatest strengths as an industry has always been that we have bipartisan support. And if you look at our value of proposition, if you look at it, what it is that we do for our country, we drive investments in rural communities. We empower American drivers with more choice and lower prices. We can accelerate innovation in America's bioeconomy. We can secure American dominance in things like sustainable aviation fuel, and we can unlock foreign markets for American bioproducts. So there's so much potential for us, and our value and what we deliver, it speaks to both Republicans and it speaks to both Democrats. And we have been able to maintain bipartisan support moving forward. And so whatever the outcome of the election is, whatever American people decide in terms of who they want their elected leaders to be, we will be in a position as an industry to work effectively with lawmakers in Congress, with the next administration. We have really important priorities. We've got to get year-round E15. We've got to get tax guidance for 45Z so we can really accelerate the decarbonization in the industry. We have to make sure that the renewable fuel standard remains strong and intact and spurs growth, and we have got to make sure that we have a free and fair trade environment. So there's a lot of exciting things in play for the industry. I just sense the innovation and the optimism. And we've got exciting opportunities ahead regardless of whatever the election outcomes may be.
Our thanks to Emily Score, CEO of Growth Energy, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.